Cameron. How you feeling, man?
I'm feeling great. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
First of all, your mother's being in town, so I get to ask you an atypical Black Southern question. How your mama doing?
I mean, my mom is great, and I'm glad she's staying with us. It's a long term visit. Last night was a little bit hairy because we were seeing my son play football, and it was a nighttime Maryland football game. So
right.
It was pretty intense. Getting mom out of there wasn't easy, but you know, everything's great.
Have you moved her in with you?
Is she gonna No. But she is doing a long term stay with us.
She's gonna stay with you long term.
Yeah, it's gonna be nice.
Yeah, my brother and I think about that because our parents are both my parents are still with us, but they're in their 80s. You know, I live here in the DMV. My brother lives in Texas, in Austin. They live in San Antonio, so he's constantly having to, you know, got to go check and make sure they're all right. So we think about shit like that, you know, as time begins to go, like, are we going to have to move her in with one of us, or is...
It's a question. I did a high school event a few years ago with Greg Popovich and Cornel West at a high school in San Antonio.
You remember the high school?
I don't, but it was massive. That's all I remember.
They're all massive. I went to a 5A high school. My graduating class was over 700.
Pretty massive.
Yeah, they're all massive. And then it got so big that you have what they call big 5A and little 5A. Big 5A is like 7,800 in the graduating class. Little 5A would be, and this is little 5A, would be 5,600 in the graduating class. And that's just seniors. You know, yeah.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. And football is king.
I mean, it's Texas. I'd expect nothing less.
Yeah, yeah. Big 5A schools are where it's at.
I've just been working through in my mind for this video essay I did for my show, Edge of Sports TV. Mm-hmm. About why football is so unpopular in the rest of the world and yet so popular here.
Because I think it's quintessentially American.
Well, that's certainly true.
I think it's quintessentially American. And I also think it's...
But isn't baseball? Isn't basketball?
It's funny you should say that we're going to talk about football, but football is really just the container for us to talk about other things.
Of course. It's a lens.
Yes, because it has occurred to me that football for me, because I kind of went away from football after Cap when everything was going on with Colin. I just kind of was like, I can't do this in good nature. And mm-hmm. watching and listening to people lie about him, lie about his abilities, lie about why he's doing what he's doing. I'm talking about sports announcers who know better. Just flat out, oh, he's not that good. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know the game. Why are you saying that? You know, it was like this big, I think Howard Bryant said it. It was like there was a need to subjugate him. He said it on the show with Stephen A. Smith. It was like there's a need to buck him, to subjugate him, to break him. Everybody was involved in it. Everybody was, and it drove me away. But after I stopped watching is when I quickly came to realize that you can't get away from football in our culture.
There's no getting away from it. It's astounding. I did a film about this called Behind the Shield. If folks want to check that out, behindtheshieldmovie.com. And one of the things in our research that became so clear is that you're right that football is uniquely American, but there are a lot of uniquely American things that catch the world by storm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Marvel Comics, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've got the Captain America is a global icon. Mm-hmm. But there's something about football that's so specifically American because its founding was really rooted in the turn of the 20th century and this thirst for American empire and the powers that be, like Teddy Roosevelt, seeing football as the perfect training ground for young Ivy League men to prove their worth and be ready to rule the next American century. Now, dozens of Ivy League kids died on the football field because the games basically resembled Braveheart back then, before they had rules that were codified. Actually, the founding of the NCAA was in response to football deaths. People, they never talk about that. because there still are football deaths, but there were so many more back then, and people wanted to abolish the game because of it. But Teddy Roosevelt, you know, he had a little bit of power back then. He fought for this on the grounds of, as the words he used were stuff like, masterful nations must play these kinds of rugged sports. So I think it's just so baked into the cake of like U.S. exceptionalism and expansionism that the rest of the world, I think, recoils in the face of it. I love it. I watch it. But I
was going to say that it's very, it's a warlike game. It's, yes. Soccer is not.
No.
Football is not. American football is extremely warlike. You take ground, you hold ground, you beat your enemy into submission. You take ground, hold ground, beat your enemy into submission. Every play, take ground, hold ground, beat your enemy into submission. Try not to lose ground. If that ain't American, I don't know what is.
Exactly. And it gets to the question of settler colonialism, too.
Right.
Because, you know, it's forming and growing right when the U.S. is about to leap to expand throughout Latin America, specifically with a series of invasions throughout. But also, it comes on the tail end of the entire conquering and displacement of Native mm-hmm. peoples in the United States as well. So this idea of, you know, not just Monroe Doctrine stuff in Western Hemisphere, but also Manifest Destiny, and football being an expression of Manifest Destiny. And even in the most scandalous European countries who performed so many ill imperial ventures throughout the world and have such high body counts, that Manifest Destiny piece is specific to the United States mm-hmm. and in a way that, I mean, that's the U.S. philosophy. Go West, young man.
Right.
That to me is what has football, and particularly the NFL, so intertwined in our national psyche. And it's intertwined in mine too. It would take a lobotomy for me to not think about football. Now, some of that's my job, but some of that is like, if I'm being honest, there is this visceral thrill to the game.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that, because you said, how old is your son?
15.
So you have a 15-year-old that plays.
Yes.
Does that bother you?
Yes.
15-year-old, it does bother you.
Very much.
Yeah. You a big kid?
He plays quarterback.
Oh, God.
And every play, they're out to get him. And my wife's from an athletic family, so he's like 6'1", 6'2". And so he's slender. So I worry about him, but he's got a great gun. He's a lefty. Look at that great gun. That's what I'm calling my own son's arm.
Right.
That's what I mean by intertwined in the psyche. Right. I'm surprised I'm not calling him a field general who throws bullets and bombs. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, look, he is obviously white, so obviously he's a heady, smart kid who's a who's a tactical field general out there.
Yes,
obviously, that's scrappy. That goes without saying.
he's got grit. Wow. But the thing,
is your wife worried?
Yeah. Every week is terrible. But the thing is, and this is how we've chosen to raise our kids always, is like, if they have a pet, we've said to them from when they were babies, like, if you have a passion and it doesn't hurt others, we're going to help you mm-hmm. pursue that. Mm-hmm. And this isn't only a passion for my kid. This is like what he hangs his hat on in every respect. Like, oh, you want me to do well in school? I got to play football. So I'm, you know, motivated to do so. Oh, you know, not no drugs, no alcohol, like all of this stuff for him, because he goes to a massive public school, you know,
right.
Kids are vaping in the bathroom, you know, it's like he walks the straight and narrow. And for him, football is a great motivation for that. Like, he was exhausted yesterday after the game. It was a 6:30 game. We didn't get home, I'm not joking around, till like 10:30 or 11. We're just exhausted. The game was a big pain in the ass for reasons I won't share. So we're all just there. And I look at him and I say, what's your first class tomorrow? And he says, health class. And I say, well, you want to sleep in? I'll drive you in after health class. He said, I'm not skipping classes, Dad, in season. And it's just like, okay, that's the way it is.
All right. Do you sometimes feel a tinge of guilt or regret? Or obviously you, I don't want to say obviously, but it, generally it is that the parent is the gateway into the sport for the child because they're watching with you. They're seeing your excitement. And then at some point, you probably start throwing the ball around with him. It's the gateway in. So
a little guilt, but at the same time, you know, I like I said, I did that documentary, which he's seen. I've never not talked to him about issues like CTE, about concussions. So what I tell myself is that, you know, as much as this hurts to see him out there and as much it doesn't hurt, but anxiety, as much anxiety as it causes with my wife and me to see him out there, the flip side of that anxiety is like, look, what else can we tell him at this point about why he shouldn't play, you know? And if I believed for a second that if I like swore off football, he would stop playing tomorrow, I would do it in a heartbeat. And I'm not like a football obsessive, but you're absolutely right. Every sport, you know, I had a catch with him with football. I wanted him to play basketball because he was tall and I played basketball in high school. So I had him out there doing hoops all the time and he was good at it too. But it's just like the passion is the passion. Yeah. His runs towards this very brutal sport that freaks me out all the damn time.
I mean, I get it. I'm teaching my daughter right now boxing and kickboxing, but she doesn't spar. You know, I don't have her in a gym sparring. I would probably feel safer about her sparring than playing tackle football.
Yeah.
Because I can keep the sparring under control. You can't keep a football game under control. There's no possible way. There's no possible way to keep practice under control. You can't.
No, I mean, they have them wear the yellow jersey, you know, there's all these rules. But I always tell people, you know, football today is like a cigarette with a massive filter, you know, and you may say it's safer than some unfiltered Camel, but that doesn't mean it's safe.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? There's no such thing as a cancer-free cigarette. That does not exist.
Right.
So you can make it safer, but you're not never going to make it safe. It's got a 100% injury rate, as the NFLPA former head Damar Smith would always say to me. But then at the same time, it's like as I was like thinking like, okay, do I put myself bodily between him and the football field? I asked a lot of people that I knew, and I was like, did you play high school football? And, you know, more often than not, I got really good stories out of it. So I'm really just crossing my fingers and hoping that in the lottery of life, he gets through this. I mean, it's tough. I'm not going to say it's not tough. And we're going to take it one season at a time. And as well, and that this part's really important. He knows we got a one and done rule when it comes to concussions.
Okay.
Happens once, we're done.
He's going to get a concussion, though.
I know.
There's no way around it.
We're done. Done.
Do you think he'll try to hide it from you?
No.
You know,
just don't have that kind of relationship.
He's going to get one.
Yeah.
You know, that would be the thing. If I had my daughter fighting, you know, at some point you're gonna get rocked. There's no way around it.
So that'll be the day we ring the whistle and say, let's let that brain bruise heal. Cause that's what a concussion really is. Yep. It's a bruise on your brain. And, you know, a concussion in and of itself is not life altering, but a concussion that is not allowed to heal can be life altering. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're going to heal him up and then he's going to find something else to do.
Let me tell you something. I took a left hook from James Leha one time, world champion, Jesse James Leha. I took a full on left hook from him in sparring in the second round, and I was buzzed. I didn't get clear until I was sitting on my couch hours later watching Tuesday Night Fights. Remember Tuesday Night Fights used to come on WSA 9? I was watching Tuesday Night Fights. That happened. We were sparring around 6. I was sitting on my couch at 9:30 when I finally kind of cleared out.
Dang.
And that was one shot. And he backed off because he saw me buckle a little bit.
I mean, I think, you know, I visited the Muhammad Ali. If you've never done this, Randolph, you got to do this. The Muhammad Ali Center in Louisville.
I do need to do that.
It's a bucket list experience to go there. It's amazing. And they have this exhibit where you can, there's a shadow of Muhammad Ali boxing at his speed. Mm-hmm. And you shadow box with Muhammad Ali.
Oh.
And challenge you to see if you can last 3 minutes and keep up the pace.
Yeah.
Man, 20 seconds maybe?
Yeah.
30 seconds I lasted, and I was in good shape back then too. I lasted maybe 30 seconds. I mean, the amount of stamina it takes to do it properly is just off the page.
And then somebody's hitting you.
I just was trying to keep up from a stamina perspective. Shoot.
Somebody's hitting you.
When you can't dog it. Like, you know, you can play soccer and, you know, walk up, you know, basketball, you walk up the court.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like Buster Mathis Jr. said his father told him, but there, he and Buster Mathis Sr. were both pro boxers. And he said, Daddy, should I play football or should I box? And he said, son, please play football because nobody plays boxing.
Yeah. 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 And Jr. was pretty good. He was a solid pro.
Yes.
That's all you can ever really hope for in a career is to be a solid pro. Not to be a tomato can. You just want to be a solid pro.
And come out with your head intact.
Everything intact.
You know this.
It's my problem with Errol Spence right now.
You know this better than I do, but you know, for me, I fell in love with boxing with the 84 Olympics. And you think back to people like Meldrick Taylor and Pernell
Whitaker. Yeah.
I mean, people, Tyrell Biggs, I mean, people paid a real price for being on that team.
Meldrick Taylor is gone.
Yeah.
I don't even know if he's still alive, but I know he is. I was just listening to Shane Mosley the other day on YouTube talking about just things that are going on right now. He's slurring.
Oh, wow.
He's slurring. I can hear it. He's slurring. He was a very sharp speaking man. He's slurring now. He's slurring now. He doesn't look like he's lost any of his physical capacity or anything like that, but he's definitely slurring. I'm like, I can hear it. He's definitely slurring.
You know,
Zab Judah is too, a little bit. I hear Zab Judah talking. He is a little bit also.
What about Floyd?
Floyd never gets hit. Floyd's fine.
Never gets hit. Yeah.
He never gets hit. Bernard Hopkins, no problems. Floyd, no problems.
Well, B Hop is a legend. Floyd is another conversation.
Guys who never got hit. Pernell never had any problems. Guys who never get hit. If you're not getting hit, you know, you're not taking punishment, you'd be all right. It's hard because you have to expect to get hit. But if you're a defensive guy, you come out fine.
Amazing. I'll tell you, in my dorm room in college was a picture I tore out of Sports Illustrated right over my desk of Pernell Whitaker. It's the most amazing photo. He's in like a full squat looking up and going like this, like a little woo at Chavez, who's trying to hit him. Yeah,
I was at that fight.
Oh, that's insane.
I was at that fight. He called it the Dipsy Doodle.
Oh, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the Dipsy Doodle. He did it to me.
Oh, my God.
Did it to me back many years ago when I was a younger man. Did it to me. That really hurt when I found out he was hit by a car. It really hurt. Really hurt me. Yeah, he was also an extremely nice guy.
I don't doubt it. If I had skills like that, I'd be a nice guy too.
Yeah, he was an extremely nice guy. Yeah, extremely nice guy. Yeah, they did his Dipsy Doodle, and he would just make you miss, and then he might laugh at you, or he might light you up and pull away and laugh at you. Didn't take a lot of shots.
Dipsy Doodle was a very popular, now out of business, 1980s corn chip.
The Dipsy Doodle.
Pernell, he's like, Dipsy Doodles. That's my move.
Yeah, I was at the Alamo Dome. I was at that fight. And I remember as soon as they rang the bell, Joe Sousa, who was James's cut man, James Leha's, because Leha fought Azuma Nelson on that fight. So that's why we were all there, because people from the gym came, and I had been one of his sparring partners a little bit leading up to it. And we were backstage, the fight ended. And Sousa looked around and said, pick everything up. We're getting out of here right now. Because when they announce Pernell wins this, this place is going to go berserk. We have to leave now. And they called it a draw.
Wow.
They called it a draw.
It's just absurdness.
It was absurd. It was an absurd fight. Chavez never landed a shot on him. It was
the
absurd.
Deference shown Chavez is just ridiculous.
It was crazy. We were out. We were already walking out. They called it a draw. What?
You're already walking out. That's got to be a story unto itself.
Yeah, and then we went to an after party for James, and he had a little party at a ballroom, and that was all the conversation. I cannot believe that they took that fight from Pernell. And then it didn't even hurt him in the end because everybody was like, he won. Everybody was like, he won it. He won. It was no question. He won it going away. You know, if anything, that fight elevated him.
Look at us talking about early 90s boxing.
Early 90s, baby. That's when it was at.
Is this your audience?
Really? They know me. They know what they get. This is what you get. The thing about football, as we'll steer back, the thing about football is it's just like early 90s boxing. Okay.
Mark Breland.
The thing about football is that football is, for me, it's America's quintessential relationship with blackness is laid out in football. It's a perfect distillation of America's relationship with blackness. It's the not basketball, because basketball is the black sport. Mm-hmm. Even though there are white owners, basketball is still seen as a black sport. Football is not, even though the majority of the players are black. Football is seen as a quintessentially white. I don't understand this. You think it wouldn't be, but it's seen as a white possession that black people are involved in, and in some capacity are also possessed by or possessions of, which makes the black players possessions of whiteness.
Exactly.
In my opinion, I'm just kind of spitballing that right now. It's the first time I've thought about that, but yeah, they're kind of possessions of whiteness.
No, this is real. And because football is controlled by white ownership, or I should say non-black ownership, because there is one owner
of
color out in Jacksonville.
Yeah.
So it's controlled by non-black ownership with black talent. You know, we still have this problem. Like decades ago, Jesse Jackson called it vertical segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did a book with Michael Bennett, who was on the Seahawks at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the NFL, first of all, he said NFL among the players, they call it N-word, although he didn't say N-word, N-word for lease.
Yeah.
And he said for the book, and this was open some eyebrows, he said, people think we're integrated. We're just not.
Yeah.
It's, if you look at the sport as a whole, this is not an integrated operation. And that's why I think it's so important that Jim Trotter, who somehow is 60 years old, I don't even know that.
I just tweeted at him today that just stop lying and just go ahead and tell us that you're 160 years old because you're a vampire. Just admit it, man. Just
seriously.
Just admit the shit. Don't.
There's some vampirical tendencies.
I didn't realize. He's been in the game for 30 years doing this. 30 years.
30 years. And he's reporting it all. And it's interesting because, like Brian Flores, the former head coach of the Miami Dolphins, who's issued his lawsuit, that both of them, you know, over the years during Kaepernick, you know, there was some skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
About what Colin was saying and what he was doing. And I think Colin uncorked a lot of brains to start thinking about how this operates systemically in football.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's not in the sport, not because he pissed off white fans or took on the police. He's not in the sport because in the very, very specific racial economy of football, everybody, particularly your black quarterback, better, you know, shut up and throw.
Yeah, you got to.
They need obedience in football in a way. They demand obedience in football in a way that I think is pretty unique compared to other sports.
And it ripples out from. It's not just the players; it's coaches. Any blackness that's associated with football there's a demand of obedience. It's filtered to ESPN. It's filtered to people who commentate on football. Who should know better? This is the thing I was talking about with Kaepernick. When you say he just can't play, and that's why they don't like him, you know that that's a lie. You know that. So you're just going to piss in my face as a viewer listening to you, the pundit who knows this sport, tell me that he's just not good. That doesn't make sense. And then I'm looking at the people that they're pulling out of mothballs.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're out of your fucking mind.
Whiz in your face and tell you it's raining. The first one was when the Dolphins QB got hurt. I forget which one. They're always getting hurt. And they signed Jay Cutler out of the mothballs, as you said. And that to me was like super, like that was a, you know, whiz in my face and tell me it's raining moment, because the one thing that they always also said about Colin, some of them were just, you know, lying openly, like you said, and were just like, oh, he can't play. But then some people said, well, do you really want a distraction like that on your football team? Football, you know, you need this, you need that, as if being political and caring about people and giving a damn that people were killed by police and getting the police are getting paid leave for it. And there's no justice. All of this stuff is somehow a distraction from winning football games.
You put that in your book, The Kaepernick Effect.
Ooh, my God. I wasn't even trying to do a plug.
Man. That's in your book. I read that line. I was like, yeah, as if somehow caring for a community of people who we all know there's a serious problem in going on with the way society treats it, as if caring for that is somehow political. How is that a political statement?
Ridiculous.
It's not. It can't be, unless you just say it is. That's the thing. It is because I say it is.
I think Donald Trump also played a role in this. I don't agree with people who put it all on Donald Trump, because white nationalism, John Birchers, that's as American as apple pie.
Yes.
Donald Trump did not create that. But that doesn't mean Donald Trump also doesn't have a powerful lizard brain.
Yeah.
That is somehow tied into what is going to polarize the populace. Mm-hmm. So here's Colin Kaepernick, as you said, trying to make what I would describe as a humanist statement.
Yes.
It was Donald Trump whose lizard instinct said, I'm going to make this a political statement, and the people who are on my team, we're going to demonize him and we're going to call him a son of a bitch. And things that were so beyond the pale that we'd never really heard a politician do before. What it did was it cut the leash on a lot of rabid dogs out there. So, you know, there are reports of, you know, Colin Kaepernick's image at firing ranges and, you know, people shooting it. This, like, some FBI dog training, like canine dog training, had someone dressed up like Kaepernick, you know, wearing like the protective suit while dogs like ripped the jersey off. There's video of this.
Yeah.
This is, this country, I think, has a deep sickness, violent white supremacy that, you know, I think the struggle of the Black freedom struggle helped put it, you know, on its heels for a little bit. But, you know, you see it coming back with a vengeance that I think should concern us all.
Well, the backlash is always to be expected. I remember after George Floyd, I remember writing for Open Mic. Reese and I talked about it, and you know, we're all having this great moment with George Floyd, and it was like there were many of us who were like, okay, this ends though. We know what the next thing is. This is the first part. The next thing is the backlash to this. That's what's coming. It's what's coming because we've seen it before.
Yeah.
And it happened. Everything that was said, none of that happened. And
I really feel you there. I was of a hope that, you know, feels very naive at this moment, but of a hope that, wait a minute, these are the biggest demonstrations in the history of the United States in terms of sheer numbers.
In the world,
yeah. We've never had a demo in the U.S. that hit all 50 states with the same issue in the same period of time. All 50 states. Idaho, their BLM protests. Everywhere, Alaska, you know, it's happening all over the place. And a lot of white people at these demos.
This was the moment.
Yes.
So it's I'll give you a moment better, though. I'll give you another moment. My moment, not to cut you off, but my moment, because they go together. My moment was Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. Now, I voted for Hillary Clinton, not even a question. It wasn't a question in my mind. But I knew a lot of Black people who were like, I'm just not going to vote. And a lot of people, because all of us thought that there is no way that whiteness will elect Donald Trump. Yeah. We all thought that, again, in retrospect, very naive, very naive. But we all thought that. And I was like, when that next day, I said, I will never make the mistake of trusting whiteness again. And I will not make that mistake.
I can't afford to. Yeah. the stupidest three words in political coverage happened often during the Obama administration, where these reporters on CNN or MSNBC would say, demography is destiny, meaning that the U.S. is becoming non-white enough.
Right.
Republicans can't run on the old dog whistle Reagan games.
Yes.
And you even had leading members of the Republican Party, like the head of the RNC after Obama won twice, coming out with these position papers about how to appeal to people of color in the context of a multiracial democracy. And Donald Trump said, fuck that.
Yeah.
If I can get enough white people to vote for me, and if I could make some shallow fascist inroads in some communities of color, that'll be enough.
Yeah.
And think about, you know, Black getting people, because of the Electoral College, blah, blah, blah. Sorry.
Black people, we overwhelmingly vote Democrat, but it's not that Black people overwhelmingly vote. What it is that Black people are overwhelmingly progressive. I keep hearing people say, Black people are, well, you know, Black people are really conservative. First of all, you need to tell them what conservative is, because Black people overwhelmingly vote. We will vote for the progressive. And you're like, well, you know, Black people used to support the Republican Party. Yeah, because it was progressive. It was the progressive party. We're the most progressive group in this country as a group, as an aggregate group. We're easily more progressive than anybody else, because we know what the outcome is going to be if we're not. We will support the progressive candidate, you know, so overwhelmingly. And you can go back and look at the numbers. The numbers bear that out, you know, overwhelmingly. So, yeah, you'll pull in, you know, a couple more percentage points of the Black male for whatever, these fucking idiots. But that doesn't let off the hook the overwhelming number of white people who repeatedly vote for this, who have been voting for this since 1964. And what happened in 1964? The Civil Rights Act was passed.
Exactly. And what was it, LBJ. Or a backer of LBJ who said, we just lost
LBJ. That's LBJ. For generation. We just lost the white vote for generation. Oh, no, it was more than a generation.
Oh, forever.
Yeah, it was more than a generation.
Ridiculous.
Which is exactly where football is at. It's a retrenchment. It's funny, we were talking about, I wrote this down yesterday because this woman, Bills reporter Maddie Glab, she was caught on a hot mic saying this was Thursday. There's no control over Stephon Diggs. Dude's going to do what he wants to do. He looks in the face and say, fuck you. It said expletive, but I'm sure that's fuck you. That's the only word that goes in there. That's how he treats everybody. To which she had to then come out and do the apology statement. No, he treats me nice, but he immediately came back and was like, I treat everybody with respect. I don't know what she's talking about. I'm like, yes, because she feels, even as a reporter, a Bills reporter for the team you play on, she has a sense of ownership over you.
Yep. Like,
you have to talk to me and you have to treat me in this manner. And if you don't, well, then you're not playing your part right, because you're just being an asshole. You're being an asshole to me. You're being an asshole to me. I'm like, well, he's going to now leave. If I was him, I'd be like, I'm getting the fuck off this team. I don't need to be here. I don't need to be in this fucking town.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm good. Awesome. I can go anywhere.
Get out. No, the Bill and their owner, Terry Pegula. I mean, Jim Trotter is saying, you know, in his lawsuit, that they're talking, go back. He's saying, go back to Africa. Of course, he denies it now. But I wonder who I'm going to believe.
Right.
Racist ass owner or from Buffalo.
Yeah.
Of all places. Or Jim Trotter, who's been doing this for 30 years.
Right.
I wonder who I'm going to believe.
When I saw him yesterday on Brother from Another, listening to him talk, I remember going back, listening to him ask Goodell the question at the owners meeting.
Yep.
You know, you said you were going to have, you were going to address these issues in the newsroom. You didn't. This is the second year now I'm asking you this. 3 weeks later, he's fired. He brings about the lawsuit. And now it's, well, Stephen A. Smith said this, and my listeners know I bang on Stephen A. Smith a lot. It's not that I bang on Stephen A. Smith a lot. I guess it is. I don't like company men. Like, company first, everything else. There are some things that are bigger than company. You know, I understand you made a lot of money, but that shouldn't be. There's more to life than just I make $12 million a year. So good for me. Or everything is equal and everything is both sides. No. He said on his podcast yesterday, Stephen A. said that, yes, it's okay, but you just can't confront your boss openly in public and not expect to get fired. He said, I'm quoting Stephen A., I was talking to Black bosses of other places, and as Black men, they said they would have fired him. Okay. And I'm like, okay, whatever. Then I hear Jim yesterday on Brother from Another, where he drops in same day, where he says, okay, I talked to them behind the scenes for 2.5 years. I kept it quiet and just talked to them. They didn't do anything. So I'm like, I have to do this publicly now because there's no movement happening. Okay. I was telling Andy, we were talking about it. I said, listen, if I'm doing something and you, Dave, asked me in a press conference, what am I doing? I'm glad you asked me because here's what we're doing. I'm doing this. But if you, Dave, ask me in a press conference and I'm not doing anything, now I'm going to be mad. Okay. Because you're supposed to be looking out for me. You work for the NFL. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? Now I'm mad. The only reason I'm mad is because I'm not doing anything.
When I spoke to Jim Trotter earlier this week, he spoke about his own, and I actually really respect him for being straight up about this, his own naivete when he went from, you know, Sports Illustrated, ESPN, to working for NFL.com, that his boss was not Roger Goodell, that his boss would be the head of NFL media.
Right.
That's who he was accountable to. And it's a well-known fact that that press conference, that State of the League, Roger Goodell, Super Bowl press conference that everybody watches where Jim Trotter correctly blew up Goodell's spot. Everybody knows that it's a fight to see who can ask the most powder puff question. Mm-hmm. It's a joke. Real reporters think that press conference is a big fat joke. And here's Jim Trotter actually doing his job and trying to hold power to account. You know the old expression about journalism, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Who is more comfortable than Roger Goodell with his $1 million a year salary? And he should be challenged about this. And the NFL even paid lip service, as Jim Trotter said. If we're not being true to our values of diversity, equity, and inclusion, you need to let us know. So Jim Trotter is actually trying to hold them to account as they challenged the press to do. But, you know, this is thinking that the NFL.com is in any way an independent operation. I mean, like Jim said to me, he said, when it comes to franchise owners, we could report on it if other outlets were reporting on it.
That's crazy. It just, for people who don't quite understand, explain that, because I get it. But explain that we can't report on it. You want to explain that? That's
absolutely bananas. Well, what it comes down to is that's a way to say you cannot dig on anything these franchise owners are doing. Hey, reporter, even though you work for Sports Illustrated and ESPN and you have a whole history of looking at things like shady stadium deals or sexual harassment at the Washington team or any of the disgusting things. Jerry Jones, my God, that man's life is just a horror show of the devil's work. I mean, you can't dig into any of that. You're being told that. You're being told if another reporter actually does the work, you can piggyback on it. But you can't do your own work. And I don't know, to me, that's like asking a reporter. You know, Jim Trotter used the word emasculated when he quoted to me this assistant coach who never got a shot because of the color of his skin. Mm-hmm. And I think of that word emasculate too, even though I'll make it far more gender fluid and neutral than that. But just that idea of having your ears pinned back in terms of what you are or are not allowed to talk about.
Baldwin once said that the North and South both castrate you. Mm. It's just in how they do it. But they both do it. It's just in how they do it. It's the same thing with the NFL. Now, are you willing to accept it? Obviously, Jim's not, and he's a man of high. I don't know how the NFL thinks to just back out of this. You can't throw money at the man. That's not going to work.
No.
You can deny it, but you, in order to deny it, you have to be willing to look Jim Trotter in his face and call him a liar. Okay, you can do that. Yeah, they're going to do it. No one believes it. I don't know.
No one believes it.
No journalist can believe that.
Yeah, and also he's like Brian Flores. There is not a money incentive in what they are doing, and they are being very open about that.
Yeah,
Jim Trotter's got a good job now with the Athletic. You know, Brian Flores is the defensive coordinator for the Vikings. That's a good. Yeah. It's not about the money.
Yeah,
it's like they're actually these are people who have tried to, like you said, tried to do the right thing.
Right.
And run up into a wall time and again. Because, you know, even though people of all shades of the Benetton rainbow love the National Football League in this country, it is essentially, you know, black bodies and black minds under constant threat for the purposes of white consumption. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's all stripped away. That's what they're selling.
Yes. And if these white folks don't like it, then we're going to lose somehow money. So we have to cater to whatever whiteness says, and every aspect of whiteness. And if that means we have to cater to racism, then we just cater to racism. It's fine.
And that's what makes me cry about my own naivete about the 2020 protests. Because I'm looking at this and I'm like, will this young generation, will my daughter's generation, will my son's generation, mm-hmm. will they redefine whiteness? Can that be done? Will they renounce whiteness? Will it be reformed? Is there a way that we can uproot its most pernicious effects on both the psyche and the systemic nature of our society? And it's like, man, was that really just 3 years ago?
Right, right. I call it going home. I often say at some point, you're in college, you're very radical, you're this, you're that. And then at some point you go on home, you buy the house, you become a Republican.
You opt out.
It's just going home to whiteness. You go on home to whiteness because whiteness is comfortable.
Yeah.
You got it.
I think a lot about that as someone who, you know, is third generation in this country, Jewish, all that stuff, about how, you know, Jews have had whiteness bestowed on them for quite a few years after first generation. Mm-hmm. But now you see like anti-Semitism roaring back. Mm-hmm. And people openly talking about not Judeo-Christian ethics, which the Republicans used to say, but now it's Christian nationalism. It's right. White nationalism. It's temples being shot up. It's needing armed security on high holy days. And you see and it's anti-Semitism being trafficked openly by Elon Musk with the broadest possible platform you can imagine. And it's that way that they can also make whiteness conditional when they need to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll take it from you.
Yeah.
That's the threat. I'll cast you down with the black people. That's the threat.
Yeah.
And that's the enticement for Latinos now.
Yeah.
Latino community. That's the enticement. You can be part of this. You know, you can be part of this. But if you fuck it off and start supporting those people, we will cast you down. Colin Kaepernick's great sin was standing up for blackness.
Yes.
That's his sin. Jim mm-hmm. Trotter's sin, standing up for blackness. Mm-hmm. That's the worst of things, is to say, why aren't you embracing blackness? Mm-hmm. Why are you running blackness down? When you stand up for blackness, they'll just try to destroy you.
Man, and it's so interesting too. Like people in this country have no global sense of history or anything. Like, I've heard more than one, you know, fascistic right winger say on Twitter, it's like, how can you say our movement is racist? Look at the Proud Boys. There are Latinos in the Proud Boys. That shows we're not racist. And it's like, you don't think there's a history of fascism and colorism in Latin America?
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, are you kidding me? Like, I lived in Chile where there was a dictatorship for 18 years that also oppressed the indigenous population. It's like, we may have patented it in this country, but it was patented for export,
yeah,
not just for internal consumption.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. What America did with racism was multiplied by 10, you know. But let's not act like it's not everywhere in the world.
Well, even I have a book on my shelf right here. I think it's called Hitler's Model, and it is about how Germans.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. Yep, like, studied the Jim Crow South. So.
Yep. And studied the Jim Crow South and decided that some of the things were too extreme even for them. Like, well, we can't do that. You know, some of the things, we'll kill them all, but some of this shit y'all talking about, we can't do. You know.
I'm sorry, my dog, he's on a.
I'm not a fan of Hitler. Good for you, baby.
Yeah, apologies. You said you like dog sounds. My dog sounds are particularly... No, I'm going to hit the mute button as you talk here, Rand.
Is she mad at something?
She's super pumped because my wife, who is a high school teacher over at Jackson Reed, she just came home.
Oh, okay.
So doggy's tripping.
We'll let her be excited. She got to be excited.
Mommy's home.
Her mommy's home. She don't get like that when daddy comes home. She always looks at you out of that good eye.
Yeah, one eye. And he goes, sup?
Hey, you're back, like, huh? Good. Give me some food.
This is what, when I come home, it's sort of like she's a bar fly.
Yeah.
The bar. Head down. Looks up. Kindly gives me one of these little chin. You know, what's up? And then I say, what's up? And then that's it.
And then, yeah. And then
it's on the head.
I also have thought that what is happening with Dion is race is mentioned tangentially. I've noticed that about Dion. It's mentioned tangentially, but it's never really said outright. You know, this is all about him being black. That's the only thing that this is about. That's the only problem all y'all seem to have is that there's a black guy doing this. Because if it was any white superstar, former superstar athlete, I don't, there's no one who's comparable to Dion as white players. But if this is a Travis Kelce was moving in the same, making the same moves that Dion was making, he'd be praised. Like, it would be amazing. Or let's say Tom Brady. It's Tom Brady now is retired and he's making the exact same moves that Dion is making. He'd be praised for left and right.
And I could say something kind of messed up about Travis Kelce exclusively dating black women and now following Taylor Swift around.
Yeah. Well, if you notice, he was, and then he cleaned up his look, and now he looks like a manager at a Safeway. And he's gone home. He's gone.
I'm not going to shoplift from.
No, absolutely not. But he does have.
No, but you're right though about.
He does have a khaki and a short sleeve white shirt, white button up shirt look about him.
He's got to have Miss Americana on his arm.
He's gone home to whiteness. Went home.
That's exactly what it all comes full circle.
He went home to whiteness. So when you see, and I'm no fan of the way Dion left Jackson State. I'm not a fan of that at all. But I want him to do well in Colorado because it's the crucible. It's the crucible of blackness, and he's upsetting everything.
I'll say two things. It's blackness, and it's also that he is better at this than they are.
Right.
When I say this, I mean X's and O's, but I also mean transfer portal.
Yes.
Putting a team together, NIL money, all of the things that define the current landscape. It's funny to watch him do commercials with Nick Saban. Saban looks like a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Compared to what Dion is doing. And that's what makes them so mad is that instead of bemoaning the new system and, oh, woe is us making $10 million a year in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, he is saying, okay, let's take this bad boy for a ride.
Right.
And that is infuriating to them that he's doing it and doing it better than they are.
His son, Shador, is making more money in his NIL deal than Dak Prescott is on his one-year deal. Now, Dak Prescott makes more in his incentive laden and all that. But just on the base salary, Shador's making more money than him.
And you know, with money comes power. And like Caleb Williams and his father just did an interview where they basically said without saying it, look, if the Arizona Cardinals have the number one pick, they better not draft us.
Right.
Because that's where good quarterbacks go to die.
Right. And that's been said before. That's been said before, but now it's a problem.
Now it's a problem.
I think it was Elway. Wasn't Elway the first one to do that?
Right, but Elway had the Yankees in his back pocket.
Yeah.
So he had power too.
Yeah. So he and it was, I seem to remember people being very much like, yeah, he should take control of his destiny and you know, because it was Elway.
Yep.
You know, yeah, I seem to remember that. You know, he should take, I think, who else did it? Eli did it.
Eli certainly did it. And
same thing. You didn't hear nothing about it. Philip Rivers ended up going
about it. Philip Rivers and his 67 kids went to San Diego.
Right, right. He had 62 then.
Oh, right, right. He's slowing down. But you're right. Let's see how it's respond. Let's see how the big response is to Caleb Williams on this.
It's going to be you go where we want you to, boy. I don't have to. I'm making good money now.
Playing in Southern California.
Yeah. I'm making good money now. He's going to leave college with a nest egg.
Yes.
And who does that?
Yeah, nobody. And he's already funded a full scholarship at Gonzaga here in DC.
Yeah.
And he's also started an organization called Caleb Cares that deals with mental health and bullying. So, you know, this is somebody who's actually taking this money and put it to use. That's why I've been saying this for a couple decades now, that the NCAA in college football is a mechanism for stealing black wealth.
Yeah.
Wealth that's created out of communities that actually need them. Mm-hmm. And putting it in the pockets of people who have no regard for these communities. So, to me, it's like, you know, if Caleb Williams wants to keep his money and light it on fire like Heath Ledger and Batman, you know, he can light the money on fire if he wants to. That's his business. But the fact that he's putting it into programs to actually help people and mm-hmm. and help his school and all the rest of it, that's what it means to keep wealth inside a community.
Right.
And not have it, you know, have that big vertical sucking sound into the pockets of the plutocracy.
Right. Right. And that has been the model now for years. So Dion, I just saw today that the Colorado State game tomorrow, I think the ticket price is $500. $500 for ticket price. Okay, so let's say it's a 60,000 seat stadium. I'm being generous. It may be bigger than that. But let's say it's a 60,000 seat stadium. I haven't done the math, but I'm going to do the math right now. Let's say it's a, Jesus, look at your books. 60,000 seat stadium. It's going to sell out. And the tickets are going for 500. 60,000.
You got this.
$530 million. On one game. On one game, $30 million.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's what, a 10-game season? He's going to sell out every game. So let's multiply that by 10.
And last year, this team
$300 million is what his program is going to generate for the University of Colorado.
That's just ticket sales, too.
Yeah, and that's just ticket sales. Whatever they're paying Deion Sanders is not nearly enough. He is woefully underpaid.
Yes.
And those kids on that team are not paid.
And I just got to say, you mentioned Jackson State. The one thing I would want to say about that is I hate this phrase, but this is truly a don't hate the player, hate the game kind of thing. It is. This is the way it's set up. It's a dirty, fucked up business, college football.
The only problem I had.
Yes.
With the game was Deion went there and said he was going there to elevate HBCUs. And then you said that God told you to go there. And you said you were going to Elevate HBCUs and that God told you to go there. Don't say those two things. If he had simply said, hey, look, I'm just like everybody else. I'm going to give these kids everything I got while I'm here. And then we will see. But you said you were there to do this and you brought God into it. And now you've moved on. You know, hurriedly, by the way, you just, I'm the fuck out of here after that second game, after that second season, you know.
Oh, man.
Which I'm fine with, but that opens the door to, so did God tell you to go to Colorado because he needs a bigger tithe? Is that more of your...
Yeah, more? And also it's like, did God tell you to go to Boulder, Colorado?
Right, right.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, they didn't. God don't want that for you.
Not to genderize God.
Yeah, God don't want that for you.
I don't want you to go to Boulder. God doesn't want anybody to go to Boulder unless you're, playing Ultimate Frisbee. And hacky sack. But, it's our dizzle, as it were. It's been so much fun to be on the show with you, man. I really appreciate you having me.
I'm really glad that we were able to do this, man. I'm glad that we were able to chop it up. Like I said, you had just been talking. I want everybody to pick up your book, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee and Changing the World. Mr. Dave Zirin, author of The People's History of Sports in the United States. It's a great book. It's about the effect of Kaepernick. I want to just say on school kids, but I think it's more of all of society, but yeah. it did talk about the school kids a lot.
The lens of school kids.
Which I have seen. You know,
the kids shall lead us.
Yeah.
I do believe that. But
before we end, though, where do you think Trotter's lawsuit goes?
Great question. I think Trotter's lawsuit is going to be, it's the nature of the American legal system. It's going to be strung out. It's going to miss the headlines. It's going to miss the opportunity to make the change that we want to see. However, if we see more protest and more agitation, both on the field and off the field, if that's able to reemerge, and we do know it will, history tells us it will reemerge, as cynical as we may feel at the moment, it will reemerge. If it crests with that reemergence, it could lead to, I think, some serious change. It's going to all depend on what happens outside that courtroom.
We shall see. It's like anything else in this country. We'll see.
I'll see.
We'll see. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you. Pet the one-eyed dog for me. Tell her I appreciate her.
I will, man. Thank you.
Don't feel shy about hollering at me, because you shouldn't have told me to stay in touch with you, because I'm going to. I told you.
With it. Holler away, sir. I'll do the same.
I'll be back at you, man. Be safe.
You as well. Bye. And keep me in the loop as to when you're on stage, okay?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Take care, buddy.